Back with you for another edition of Connecticut Today on Tuesday, January 12th. We welcomed back biologist Dr. Sarah Crawford from Southern Connecticut State University to get her opinion on all the latest news surrounding the coronavirus. Are tolls really dead in Connecticut? As far as the General Assembly is concerned, our buddy Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy joined us in the 4 o'clock hour to talk about that and more. Boys and girls, what is going on with the COVID-19 vaccinations? Now, here in Connecticut, according to what the governor says and according to what I hear from people, by the way, producer Eric gets his first shot tomorrow. So good on you, Mr. Producer. According to what we're seeing, though, hearing here on the radio station from experts and from Governor Ned Lamont, we're doing okay here in Connecticut. Not a great overall number, but we're getting there. In fact, I think so far at least about 140,000 people have gotten their first of a two-stage shot here, and about 8,000 or so have gotten the second. But we're hearing different things now about releasing the entire stockpile. Some experts say, yeah, let's get it into as many people as possible. Others are saying, well, you got to cross your fingers then if you have production problems. The feds are saying start vaccinating people 65 and over. Connecticut is saying no, 75 and over. Let's see if we can hash any of this out. Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University, joins us again. She's been with us a number of times before. Professor Crawford, Paul here again. How are you?
Hello, Paul. How are you? It's a pleasure to talk to you again today.
Well, thank you. Well, you have seen Professor Crawford a little bit of jockeying, a little bit of change of position here. A lot to talk about. Let's start initially with first, the Biden camp was deliberating this. Now the Trump camp, Secretary Azar said this morning, the notion of Professor Crawford not holding back some of these doses for a second shot as a safeguard in case of a production problem. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I've been following this rather closely. This scenario first developed in the United Kingdom, where a couple of weeks ago they decided to release their entire stockpile. And initially there was a lot of resistance among scientists and even the federal government in the United States. But now, taking a closer look at what's going on in terms of the continuously escalating number of cases and deaths, and the fact that we seem to have a bottleneck in terms of vaccine distribution, there are about 10% of the expected total number of individuals have been vaccinated so far. And we don't have enough vaccine to vaccinate as many as we need to in order to stop this upward spiral. So the idea is that we'll release everything we have, and hopefully there'll be enough to give people the second dose within approximately a month. But at the very least, what you're doing is giving the first dose, which in the UK, they found that that may afford up to 60 to maybe even 70% protection by itself. And secondly, the number of hospitalizations goes way down after the first administration. So I think the first vaccine seems to prevent the more serious consequences of infection, which is really what we're aiming for now globally, to bring down the death rate, if nothing else.
All right, Dr. Crawford, hang on. We'll do a quick break. Back with more of this fascinating discussion, more with Dr. Sarah Crawford momentarily. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. As we try and sort out some of the really changing news we've seen from over the weekend now till even today, as the Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar comes out this morning and says, okay, maybe we too will do what the Biden folks want to do, and that would be to release all doses available as they're made of the coronavirus vaccine and get at least a first dose in them. Professor of Biology, Dr. Sarah Crawford, joins us once again from Southern Connecticut State University. You know, Dr. Crawford, I was reading over the weekend, you know, some very kind of cautious statements, especially from Pfizer, saying, hey, you know, they're trying to dance a line here. They're saying, hey, our FDA approval was given on two shots 21 days apart. What are your thoughts on that? And I guess the notion is that it's not awful if you go to 28 days. I can understand where the company is in a tough situation here.
Yes, they are. And actually, we're all in a tough situation because this vaccine, the vaccines by Pfizer and Moderna were released in record time. And we have to keep track of the fact that the results have really been stunningly positive overall. But keep in mind that we haven't really done a thorough investigation of the parameters involved. I mean, nobody knows what the ideal dosing situation would be. We have limited clinical trials. We saw very high efficacy. And now we're dealing with not just the vaccine itself, but the logistics of distribution and a pandemic that is clearly spiraling increasingly out of control. So you have to do a risk-benefit analysis. And there are many opinions, but I think that, of course, Pfizer is concerned and Moderna are concerned that they won't be able to administer the vaccine the way they had planned, and there may be some detriments involved. On the other hand, we have to think about the fact that we are up to 4,000 deaths a day in the United States. So if we can do anything towards mitigation, this is going to have a profound effect. And the fact that in the UK, they found that a single dose does seem to prevent very serious complications in most people, I think is very promising. So I think release it all. Hopefully we can get people vaccinated with both doses within the 4-week planned time span. But we're going to do what we can and bring down this epidemic as fast as possible. And then we'll have more data. Every day we develop more data as we administer the vaccine. And this is observational data. It's not the best, but at least we're seeing what's going on. And hopefully we'll be able to bring down these numbers shortly because not only are the number of cases and deaths skyrocketing, we're seeing very serious mutations in the virus that are of concern. So we want to bring this down before we have further trouble.
The reason, Dr. Crawford, that a lot of health experts are probably about 50-50, half of them say, hey, this is taking a chance, is they say there's always a possibility of production glitches or production delays. You know, they're not canning tomatoes here. They're making vaccines. How often does that happen? Is that an unfounded fear? Or can you recall times when all of a sudden vaccine development lines have to grind to a halt?
You know, the situation here is really very different from traditional cases, say, with the flu vaccine, because not only do we have very unstable numbers in terms of incidence rates, but also we have a totally different production platform. And this particular type of RNA vaccine can be fairly readily produced. So although, of course, we're restraining the production capacities of these pharmaceutical companies because of what's going on, at least we do have a vaccine where the platform is fairly robust in terms of how quickly we can get this RNA vaccine prepared, packaged, and out. In fact, the problem right now isn't production. It's delivery. It's the logistics. We have a lot more vaccine available than we do have immunized individual. The immunization rate is about 10%. So I think what we really need to focus on now is getting what we have out there and distributed and having people who are in the highest risk classifications vaccinated, and then hopefully by spring we'll be able to move into the entire population in the United States.
Yeah, Dr. Crawford, there was an expert quoted by the New York Times, in fact, from Yale. It was a big story over the weekend, a long story, very well done. And this expert at Yale essentially said what you said. The manufacturer of these vaccines is really humming along well. The choke points, as he said, is the actual point where somebody rolls up their sleeve and gets the shot.
Absolutely. And it's unfortunately, the logistics are difficult. We have a form of government where we have federal control as well as state control. And the federal government has authorized distribution according to the protocols established by individual states. And the restrictions, I think, people are looking at because of the fact that it was so restricted And the pool of people receiving the vaccine, although certainly understandable in terms of healthcare workers and long-term care facility occupants, it hasn't really, it's kind of made another bottleneck. So that's why I think they're opening it up. There is a significant number of healthcare workers and people who work or reside in long-term care facilities who don't want the vaccine. And we have to respect personal choice. On the other hand, I think it's a good idea to open it up more because there's a lot of people who want to get the vaccine who can't. So I think we take what we have, distribute it as equitably as possible, and hit as many people as possible who want the vaccine, and then take it from there. But I think really at this point, we have to open up more venues for distribution, more places where people can actually get the vaccine. I know Connecticut is thinking about opening the Hartford Center for that. And we really have to start moving this along because there's no time to waste here.
One other thing before we take a break, Dr. Crawford, the notion I'm seeing of some experts who say it's not a lot, but there are some out there who say, hey, let's try half doses here. You've probably seen that. They're saying there's, you know, some leftover stuff at some of these centers, so we can do half doses. Your reaction to that? I have no idea what I'm talking about here. That sounds a little weird even to me. What do you think?
Well, you certainly do sound like you know what you're talking about. But on the other hand, I think you're absolutely right. I think we just can't have a free-for-all, you know, where people just decide what they want to do with this vaccine. It's difficult enough that we may not be able to give people the established protocol of two shots within a month. We certainly don't want to be just handing out whatever. That really could create chaos. It will be very difficult to determine whether or not people are actually protected by the vaccine that they received, how much more to give them in the future. So I don't think we want to play Russian roulette with distribution. I think we have to have a comprehensive plan. I think we have to be flexible and responsive to an ever-changing world pandemic. But on the other hand, we have to use the guidelines that have been established by the clinical trials and ongoing observational studies. And I don't think anything warrants just handing out whatever you happen to have in your back closet, you know.
All right, Dr. Crawford, hang on one more segment with you, if you please. Dr. Sarah Crawford is the guest professor of biology, Southern Connecticut State University. When we come back, we'll ask Dr. Crawford about the ages now for vaccinations. The feds come out today and they say, okay, well, maybe we should do 65 and above. Connecticut and some other states are doing 75 and above. All that and more coming up right here, 3:46 on WICC. All right, trying to figure out which way is up here as we continue with the coronavirus vaccines and the divergent dosing here. And now the notion that probably all the vaccine doses we have will be released in a push to get the vaccines into as many arms as possible. A few more minutes with Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology and virology at Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, next on the list, we're starting to see a variation here on the lower end of who is going to get vaccinated. The feds today, I think, came out and said, okay, we should start 65 and up. Governor Lamont announced yesterday, no, and here in Connecticut, we're going to be 75 and up. Is that based on science or population or the efficacy of the vaccine? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's based on all of the above, actually. The state of Connecticut was in phase 1A, and that is supposed to change around the 14th coming up. So phase 1A was just the healthcare workers, long-term facility residents, and first responders. Then we were moving into phase 1B. And the rationale for phase 1B, which would involve individuals 75 and older, was the fact that their risk for serious disease and death is about 60% higher than younger ages. So that certainly made sense. And then the essential workers and those who work in congregate settings, such as schools. And that was set to roll out in a couple of days. Now with the new CDC and federal advisory from the HHS, they're saying, let's go down to 65. because we're seeing such a bottleneck and we want to get this thing moving. And but it will be up to the states to decide. So we're not sure how Connecticut will respond. There's no doubt that we will be vaccinating very shortly by appointment individuals in the phase 1B group that I just mentioned. And they will be opening up new facilities around the state to administer these more adequately. But whether or not Connecticut will adopt the new guideline, 65, which is a significant age drop, we'll have to wait and see. But it's certainly possible that we will do that because the vaccine rate of administration is too low across the board.
Finally here, I know this changes, obviously, the nature of immunology and virology and infectious diseases, but do we know yet, doctor, do we have any grip yet as to whether or not immunizing against the strains of COVID here, is this going to become a yearly exercise every couple of years, once in a lifetime, every 3 or 5 years? Any ideas on that yet? Do we have any data?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I mean, it really goes into the analysis of the parameters of the vaccine. In other words, what's the durability? In other words, how long does this vaccine last? And how much protection does it afford? So we know that short term, it's up to 90% or so, which is very high. But do we have proof of immunity? The proof of immunity is to show that someone who received the vaccine doesn't catch the virus or at least doesn't develop a serious illness. And that's going to await further testing. We have to see. We have to see how many vaccinated people, once we get the numbers high enough, how much we see a drop in the incidence of the disease. So we haven't seen that yet. And we haven't really looked a lot at the antibody status of recipients. So we don't really know. And until we know, we can't make a firm decision. But I will say this. It looks like the protection from either having had the disease or the vaccine is at least a couple of months, maybe 5-6 months. And those antibody levels are staying high enough to suggest that it could be even a year or more. I think right now the greatest concern is that these new strains that are developing in the virus may ultimately challenge the ability of this current vaccine to be effective. And there's some concern with the newest strain that's just come out in Japan, where there's some evidence that the spike protein may be so altered as a consequence of mutation that the current vaccines may not work that well. Well, at least it looks like the antibody treatments will not work well. So we'll have to see how that develops. So I think we're running the risk of a virus that can mutate and become so altered over time that we will require a vaccine. And at the same time, look at the efficacy of the vaccine that we have for the current prevailing strains of the virus. So there's no real answer to your question, although it's a very important question. But my guess right now would be a minimum of a year. And if we can get this vaccine out and going and get the herd immunity eventually over the next year, maybe we can bring down the numbers so much that we can have a vaccine that would be stable for several years. And we won't have to deal with this issue in such a way that is currently so catastrophic in terms of the consequences of not getting this under control.
Dr. Sarah Crawford is a professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, thank you so much. As always, we do appreciate the time straightening this stuff out for us. Thank you so much, and we'll talk down the road. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Dr. Crawford. Professor Sarah Crawford there, doctor and professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Hopefully, a few things now are better understood. It's what we try to do here on Connecticut Today. As we welcome for the first time here in the year 2021, our buddy from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, he writes the Fitch Files column, and he's always sniffing around to see what's really going on at the Capitol behind all our friends who are up there saying, hey, it's great, we're going to get through this COVID thing together, and we're going to tax you. Bend over, here it comes. Mark Fitch joins us. Mark, Paul here. Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year, Paul. It's good to be back with you.
Hey, I guess tolls, Mark, I'm shocked. Let me pick myself up off the floor. I guess I guess according to your latest Fitch Files piece, which I saw pop up in my feed yesterday, and I said, of course, I guess technically, Mark, tolls are not dead, are they?
Well, I mean, one thing you can be sure of in Connecticut is, you know, bad ideas never die. They just come back. It's like a zombie movie. So this session, you know, the very beginning of session, everybody starts filing their bills, and Senators Will Haskell and Alexander Kasser both put their names on a new tolls bill for 2021 that would authorize the DOT to put electronic tolls on the interstates, so 95, 91, 84, and then parts of Route 15. And, you know, popped up on our radar last night after they filed it and put the story out. So we'll see how it goes. If you listen to some other reports, it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of appetite for having this fight again. But we'll see, because these things kind of come around and they keep coming back. And, you know, let's face it, we all know that with the coronavirus pandemic, we're looking at lower revenues to the state. That includes the special transportation fund, because less people are driving, less people are buying gas, and that means less gas tax revenue. So there is going to be some kind of reconciliation here when it comes to funding for the special transportation fund. How it comes about, though, we're not sure yet. Obviously, these two senators have their idea, but the governor and, you know, other legislative leaders might have other ideas. I think it's probably safe to say whatever the idea is, it'll probably cost us something.
Yeah, but I find it interesting, Mark, that, you know, the governor says, I'm going to try other things. Speaker Arasimowicz, who is now gone, he has stepped down. He said, tolls are dead, tolls are dead. So why file this bill? I mean, are they trying to look like heroes here? Or are, you know, I mean, will Haskell and Senator Kasser not real faces of the Democratic Party yet in Connecticut? Was this kind of done with a wink or a nod? Or what's the deal here?
Well, neither one of them ever stopped advocating for tolls. So even over the summer, when, you know, during meetings that they'd have, or, you know, little coalition groups, they would mention it. And so it never really left the, you know, the milieu, as you might say. So the idea is out there. You know, frankly, I mean, this idea started under the Malloy administration. So it's been going on since, I think I wrote my first story about it in 2016 or 2017. Yeah. So this is a multi-year thing. And, you know, especially Senator Kasser, she put a lot of work in trying to get tolls passed. So she filed her very first year as senator, she filed the first tolls bill. So I think that they believe in it. And, you know, that's one thing. And they said that, you know, if you look at the Hartford Current, Senator Haskell was interviewed there and said, hey, you know, I've advocated for this and this is what I think is right. So it's in my best interest to file this bill. Whether or not it goes anywhere is different. So, I mean, if this was a committee bill filed by the Transportation Committee, I think it'd have a lot more legs. But it's still out there and it's still something to be talked about.
Absolutely. Mark, hang on. Back with Mark Fitch momentarily. First, traffic and weather together right here, 436 on WICC. I made one of our regular check-ins with Mark Fitch. He writes the Fitch Files column periodically for the Yankee Institute. Check him out online, yankeeinstitute.org. It's the conservative think tank in Connecticut here, the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Yes, there is one here in Connecticut, believe it or not. Mark, it's tough to believe, isn't it? With all the fiscal challenges the state's going to have, as you say, fewer revenues coming in from just about everywhere, the projections about long-term obligations, what the governor's going to do with state employees coming up in a few months, I am amazed and wondering at times, Mark, why, and I know why politically, but there seem to be all these ancillary things. There's, you know, tolls and now this transportation climate initiative and this and the other. Yet nobody, I guess, wants to touch the sales tax, do they? And I know people, Mark, don't like that, but that's one of those few taxes that everybody pays. You know what I mean? To some extent, which in theory means you could spread the pain out thinner, maybe by a half cent or a cent, maybe, as I've always said, for transportation. But I haven't heard boo about that. I guess, Mark, is the political will not there to suggest things with the sales tax?
Well, the thing with the sales tax, and, you know, this, it kind of goes against Democrats' ideals in a way. You know, granted, a lot of times in Connecticut legislature, they've never seen a tax they didn't like. But because the sales tax does affect everyone equally, it's considered regressive in that, you know, the poor will pay just as much of that tax as the rich. So the counter to that that is being pushed by a lot of labor and progressive coalitions is, you know, taxing the wealthy. So raising their taxes to equal that of, you know, New York or New Jersey and implementing a new tax on capital gains or a surcharge on capital gains. So that's been the big push from the left. And obviously, you know, we saw the results of the election in Connecticut and, you know, Democrats expanded their majority. So whether it's tolls or taxing the rich or a sales tax increase, they pretty much have carte blanche to do what they want. I mean, they've got Governor Lamont is one of their party. He has been, you know, much more conservative when it comes to the issues around taxes. He doesn't seem as willing to raise them. I mean, obviously, under the last governor, we saw two major tax increases, and Connecticut's still looking at massive deficits, this time a little different than last time because of the pandemic. But that has been the solution for the last 12 years, is to just continue raising taxes, and it doesn't seem to have really gotten us anywhere. Revenues are coming in a little better than expected, but in the long term, this is going to hurt, and they're going to have to do something, whether it's cutting costs or raising revenue somewhere.
If the governor, Mark, and I'm asking you to project out here, which is fine. Sure. If the governor holds the line, doesn't go for tolls, and, you know, plays a little tough, you know, draws a line with the state unions. We have that coming up in a few months. And if he doesn't go with all these tax increases, a year from now, does he get a primary challenge from the left of the party?
Oh, that's a good question.
No, because seriously, I was thinking about that the other day. A lot of Democrats don't like him.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it'd be pretty tough to primary someone in your own party when they literally have the most powerful position in the state. I don't know if the political calculus would really add up in that regard. Obviously, he'll be facing a Republican challenger of some kind. But as far as a primary from the left, I don't know. It's not that it hasn't been done before. The Working Families Party has primaried Democrats at the legislative level and won. Whether or not they'd have the gumption or the backing to do it against a sitting Democrat governor, I mean, that'd be a long shot, I think.
And this is all assuming he runs again. Listen, the governor, he looks good for his age, Mark. He's 66. No, he doesn't look that. I mean, he will be, I guess, what, 68 next year, 67 or 68. So, I mean, we don't really know what his intentions are, obviously.
Obviously, and he's also going to be running as, you know, probably from a pretty powerful position, having led Connecticut, hopefully, through the pandemic. Hopefully it'll be over by then. And I think there's probably something to be said for that as far as, you know, when it comes to reelection. You know, this is the governor who saw us through this really difficult time. You know, you can play off that politically. So I don't think a primary challenge would really work in you know, particularly the Democrats' interest. It certainly work in the Republicans' interest if it split the vote.
Is Bob Stefanowski running again?
I mean, I can't answer that.
He had that op-ed in the Wall Street Journal the other day, so that kind of almost sounded like a little bit of a campaign manifesto.
Well, I mean, Bob Stefanowski's never really stopped talking about Connecticut and the issues. Well, it's true. He hasn't really stopped talking about Connecticut and the issues it faced. And, you know, he did some great things when the pandemic first started and was able to secure a lot of personal protection equipment for first responders. So he's been out there. He's been writing op-eds. He's been on the radio doing interviews. So, I mean, I'm not saying on any inside information whatsoever, but it certainly looked that way.
Finally, Mark, there was an op-ed, not an op-ed, I'm sorry, there was a pretty involved story, I think, in the Connecticut Mirror the other day where some of the labor leaders here with the state unions are kind of already talking a little tough about, you know, trying to block any sort of mass early retirement or block any sort of efficiency rules put in that they think would eliminate jobs. You probably saw that a few weeks ago. It's going to be interesting come the next few months to see how this all shakes out with the governor, with the state unions.
Well, yeah, because basically due to some retirement changes coming up in 2022, the state is expecting a lot of people to voluntarily retire before those changes set in. So when all those people leave, you know, what the unions are trying to push back against is a hiring freeze. So they want all the people who retire to be replaced by more people, whereas the governor has indicated in the past that he's looking to create more efficiencies in government through technology, which is absolutely possible. I think we saw it done during the pandemic when the Department of Labor had a lot of trouble handling all the unemployment claims. They were able to bring in some new software and, you know, increase their efficiency. So, you know, obviously public sector unions, you know, the more people they have working, the more revenue comes into their union coffers. So they obviously don't want to lose any numbers in the state. But, you know, I think as the pandemic has shown, you can do a lot more with less using technology. And, you know, we're all working, you know, a lot of us are working from home these days. That might be a fight. If there's some kind of hiring freeze, if they're not going to replace every, you know, person by person who leaves, yeah, there's probably going to be a little anger on behalf of the unions.
Mark Fitch, as always, it's a pleasure. Folks, go to yankeeinstitute.org and check out all Mark's stuff, the Fitch files there. Mark, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you down the road. Thank you.
Happy New Year, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right, there's Mark Fitch.